Here at the Pennsylvania Game Commission, our passion is wild. Tune in to our podcast, Call of the Outdoors, as we discuss all things related to wildlife, hunting, habitat, and conservation across the Keystone State. Hear from men and women who have a passion for the outdoors and who value and work to preserve our state's wildlife resources for current and future generations.
Hello and welcome back to Call of the Outdoors, the Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast. And let me tell you, we're on the cusp of hunting season, and we got two special guests today. Our very own Nate Huck, who is our waterfowl program specialist, and Cree Martson, who is our assistant counsel and resident waterfowl hunting guru. So we're going to talk about waterfowl today because, I mean, tomorrow morning people are going to be out there and letting her rip, and it's an exciting time of year. I mean, fall's coming, you can feel it in the air, but good morning, gentlemen, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Indeed, thanks for having us, Matt.
All right, so Nate, just I know you've been a guest before and you know, our very popular stuff. You know, when everybody wants to learn about waterfowl, we come to you because you got the pulse on the Keystone State of what's happening. But if you would, just, you know, for anybody that's new listening, just give us a little background, a little intro on yourself and why you're here.
Yeah, so I've been here for 3 years now. So I am the tech rep on the Atlantic Flyway technical section, or one of the tech reps. And so I've been waterfowl hunting for as long as I've been able to. And I've been a waterfowl biologist now for 7 years total between Wyoming and Pennsylvania. So.
That's what I kind of meant. Like, I know you came from Wyoming, but now you're in Pennsylvania. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah. I spent 4 years in Wyoming as the migratory game bird biologist there. And it was a great gig, but, big game was the focus in the state. And so I moved east and a state that has a lot more interest in waterfowl and a lot more waterfowl hunters. And so it's been a great change. And yeah.
Well, we're lucky as a state, as an agency, and the resources are lucky to have you over here on our team. And I'm going to slide over here to Cree for a second. And you know, just myself being here for 3.5 years now, I run into Cree once in a while, and he always has a band around his neck or a duck call or something like that. And, you know, you're ate up with it. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about your background and what you're doing for the agency, and then a little bit about waterfowl.
Well, it in fairness, it wasn't always that way, Matt. I did not grow up in a hunting family. I don't even recall having firearms in the house. But as soon as I turned 21, I sort of glommed on to a family friend who was a hunter and a shooter. And he took me under his wing a bit, showed me the ropes, showed me how to safely operate a firearm, different firearms, single projectile, pistols, to rifles. And then I found a shotgun. And really just sort of took off with the scatter gun. Again, my background is not in the outdoors. However, after school, one of my classmates really served as a mentor to me, and was gracious enough to take me out, and enjoyed a little bit of success. To hear him put it, he just took the key and stuck it in the ignition and turned it over. The rest was on me, and he'll even say as much that he just kicked over the ignition and I kind of ran with it. Now professionally, I'm pretty blessed to be counsel. I am an attorney, licensed in the state of Pennsylvania, and the practice of law is unique. There are many, many areas and bodies of law, and I just happen to be fortunate enough that I found myself here at a state wildlife agency, being able to do conservation work. While I'm not necessarily out in the field putting flame to brush or you know, plow or anything like that, the work that I do in terms of administration, in terms of policy, in terms of the legal side of the shop, that's the kind of work that helps to allow our biologists, our habitat managers, and others to go out in the field and do the work that they do. It's sort of, if you want to liken it to building a house, it's sort of like the legal foundation. You got to have a strong basis upon which you actually go out and do the work that the that the Game Commission does.
Well, you know, the agency, wildlife, and we're just so fortunate to have folks that are end users, and conservation is a huge word, even down to the point of counsel or an attorney. And like I said earlier, we're super lucky to have both you gentlemen, and let's start talking about what we're here for and excitement. I mean, it's September 1st is right around the corner. I mean, we have early goose season, we have dove season, and lots of things happening. And just kicking it off here in Pennsylvania, Nate, is let's talk about season, bags, regs, anything new and exciting that folks should know about out there.
You know, we talked about it a little bit this last spring, but yeah, we're back to, you know, early goose is going to be September 1st to the 25th, depending on where you are. Yeah, it looks, for the most part, the state is at an 8-bird bag limit. We've got a couple of small areas around Pima Tuning and Middle Creek that'll be a little bit, have a considerably lower bag limit. But yeah, it's right here. It's exciting.
It is. And you know, I know we talked a little bit earlier, and you were talking about the mallard populations, and, mm-hmm. you know, something that we should, that all of our waterfowlers out there should probably know about.
Yeah, so we do our waterfowl surveys in April and May, and then we do a lot of number crunching throughout the months of July and August. And I say we as a collective term. I don't get to do a lot of the crunching, but folks at the Fish and Wildlife Service do a lot of that. And so we got our numbers back here just a week ago, and so the mallard population, we saw a small uptick, about 15% increase, which was a welcome news after, you know, quite a few years of decline. So most of that uptick is in the Eastern Canada numbers, so Ontario and Quebec for the most part. But and the number in the Northeast U.S. is pretty much stable. So we've seen them stable for a few years now as well. So
that's good news. That's good news for once. A lot of, you know, so much out there we hear is bad news on every front, but that's great to hear. And I'm sure, Cree, you kind of like to hear those numbers yourself.
Keep the good news coming, Nate.
Yeah. Hopefully it translates. I mean, it's all dependent on weather, but if we have a good winter, you know, it should translate to at least people seeing a few more birds.
Yeah, and if you have any questions or anything, you know, you can always hit our website with the, you know, we're talking about Pima Tuning and Middle Creek and the bag limits. You know, everything's mm-hmm. up there on the Pennsylvania Game Commission's website. So any questions there, or, you know, you can always, you know, send it to us via email, because I know, Nate, you get hit a lot with, you know, waterfowlers are pretty good at communication. I know every time we do a live or something with you, you get a lot of response from it, because people that hunt waterfowl, no matter if it's here or anywhere, they're pretty in tune. You know, obviously, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about that a lot of folks don't understand is how U.S. Fish and Wildlife, how the feds are engaged in waterfowl. A lot of people think that, you know, we just go out and make our own rules. So there's a whole different, it's a different caveat when it comes to waterfowl. If you want to just give us a Cliff Notes version of it, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, it's a pretty complex process. Born out of necessity a long time ago, back in the 30s and 40s, you know, states individually set their waterfowl seasons, and that wasn't working. Especially a big state like Texas could really pound on them, and that wasn't quite fair. So the flyway councils were born. Basically, what happens now is we get after all those number crunchers are done, we get a optimal regulatory strategy that's kind of recommended. Generally speaking, the Atlantic Flyway Technical Section and then the Atlantic Flyway Council, which is made up of administrators within all the state agencies, will kind of get together and recommend a harvest package that typically aligns with that optimal regulatory strategy. Unless we have something, you know, for example, in 2018 when the AP Canada geese crashed, they had a complete reproductive failure. The council kind of made a recommendation to go a little more conservative there. And then once it's done there, then that's elevated up to the Service Regulations Committee, which is made up of high-level administrators within the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they ultimately give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to those recommendations. For the most part, that process goes over pretty smoothly. There's some controversial stuff that runs through there every now and then that they'll kill or, you know, tell us to come back with a different idea, but for the most part, yeah, it's a pretty smooth process now.
That's awesome. You know, and again, we're lucky to, like, we brought you all the way from Wyoming, so there's something special here in Pennsylvania, especially in the hunting culture. And Cree, I'm going to I can hit it on both of you on this one. This one's kind of curiosity, but we're having a real dry year this year. I mean, you look at the river and the creeks and streams, and is that going to play any effect on waterfowl season if it stays the track that it's on now?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, waterfowl rely. I can't even describe how heavily, obviously, waterfowl rely on water. excuse me. When you've got dry years like this, you see the birds kind of congregating a little bit differently. When there's water everywhere, it tends, at least in my experience, to scatter the birds out. They can go to areas where they haven't been to loaf, to water, to feed. When there's low water or a little bit of water and no rain, kind of like there is now, you know, it impacts crops. It impacts the farmer's schedules and what they end up doing in terms of their manipulation or their own management, which of course in turn is going to have an impact on the birds that frequent those areas. You know, waterfowl is unique in that it's a category of animals that tend to rely a good deal on agriculture. So to the extent that, you know, humans are out manipulating that agriculture, the birds are going to react accordingly to what the humans are doing out there in the field. So, you know, with little bit of rain, you know, the corn's already got tassels by and large. It's browning out in some areas. I was just out this weekend scouting out some farms and things, trying to get an idea of when crops will be pulled and harvested and all of that. And I'm seeing a lot of brown out there, and I'm betting a lot of the dove hunters and early goose hunters are watching those fields as well. You know, this time of year, as warm as it is and can be, you know, you won't find them in their typical, you know, you won't find geese in their and doves in their, you know, typical winter, you know, late season places. You know, hay's coming down. You find them a lot in green fields this time of year. Heck, it's too hot to be, you know, eating corn. I mean, those birds eat corn. It's like lighting the furnace inside them. But anyway, yeah, most certainly with sparse water and little rain, it's definitely going to have an impact on not only what the farmers are doing, what the birds are doing, but what hunters are doing too to pursue them.
What's even beyond waterfowl? Anybody out there this fall?
Absolutely.
I mean, if it stays on the track that it's now, water's key. I mean, every animal out there needs it every day of their life. And sometimes, you know, at my house, I'm watching acorns drop every day, and everything's there eating them right now. And I mean, you get ducks that do have a diet of mass crop.
Absolutely.
It makes a difference. And that's why I know one thing that I'm going to take my hat off to every waterfowl hunter out there is they scout. They put their time in. They look around. They figure out what's going on. Because without that, you're just going out there on a, you know, either you're sitting in a blind or on a boat or whatever, and if you're not in the right area or you don't know what's happening out there, you don't have your finger on the pulse, it's just a good day of eating sandwiches. But most people that are really into it, they're spending a lot of time out there. Do you have any insight on the weather this year? That's something obviously we can't control, so, you know, we have to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to find water, especially for a lot of geese right now. I mean, water is key. Finding ponds that they're going to be roosting on is going to be where I'd be looking, rather than looking in fields. That's the problem with early goose season. A new field comes down every day, and they're going to switch mm-hmm. on you every single mm-hmm. day. But if you can find some ponds and really get on them.
So you guys, y'all were talking about something earlier, and I just wanted to hit on it because, obviously, if you're talking about a turkey or a whitetail, you know, most of us can judge age and you know, get kind of close. But you were talking about early season geese and, you know, most of the birds that are harvested. And then you went way up there and said, you know, you got an 8-year-old. How in the hell do you tell if a goose is 8 years old?
Well, I mean, we can only age them to hatch year versus after hatch year. So we know if it's a juvenile and we know if it's an adult, meaning it's at least in its second year. But that's about all we know just at its core.
So what Creed told me was a little bit of BS. He said, like, that white feathers on its somewhere. And
I mean, a lot of that's tied actually to some of those.
They get gray beards, you know.
A lot of that's actually tied to some of the old depending on the subspecies and things like that. There's a Canada geese, especially in the Atlantic Flyway, resident Canada geese are kind of mutts. They're made up of a lot of different subpopulations. Back when live decoys were legal, there was all sorts of subpop people who had captive flocks. And when they became illegal, people just kicked them loose. Mm. And that's where a lot of our, so that some of that eyebrow, I mean, generally, you know, some of that giant Canada goose, the Branta canadensis maxima is you know, generally tied to that.
Say that again?
Branta canadensis maxima. So.
Okay.
But, I'll drop some Latin here.
That is a word I'll never use again in my life ever.
So, but yeah, that's where some of that comes from. But, you know, you can tell a little bit by behavior, you know, when you're out looking at flocks of geese, if you see family groups, you know, generally those adults are going to be older. They don't breed for the most part until they're 3 or 4 years old. And then those juveniles, certainly they're vulnerable, but they're following mom and dad around. I mean, they know, and mom and dad have been around. They know what a hunter looks like. They're going to keep them generally a little safe. A lot of the early goose harvest, generally is kind of those 1 and 2 year old birds. Those are those, non-breeders. They're in their first year without mom and dad. And yeah, if you find a nice big flock of those non-breeders, unsuccessful breeders, that's when you can really make a big pile of birds.
Well, that goes with everything. If I don't care if you're a turkey hunter or whitetail hunter, the more birthdays they get, the smarter they, I mean, I don't know if they're smarter or they're just, they avoid humans, us as predators, more and more. And you know, that's when you have to have your lunch packed as a waterfowl hunter, when you're experiencing those kind of flocks, I would assume.
You can tell the 8-year-old bird is the one that gets to the field edge and then turns around and leaves.
Yeah.
And then you say a couple choice words, and then you
blame your buddy for being outside the blind, right? Or something. Mm-hmm. Else. Yeah.
And then you get out of breath blowing on your duck or goose call and trying to make him come back, and every once in a while one will circle around and come in there and he's laying in your decoys and it makes you look good, right?
Time to time that happens.
So let's switch to hunting real quick. I mean, we kind of hit on both, but I want to get to you, Cree. And do you have any really good tips? And I know waterfowlers are like old-time turkey hunters. They don't like to share a lot, but you know, your story is pretty awesome because you didn't start at 12 years old. You started later in life and you had a mentor in college, and you know, it's so important as we look nowadays, as you don't have to be 6, 7, 8, 9 years old to start hunting. Maybe you have some interest, and like you said, turn the key and it cranks over and all of a sudden it's in your blood.
And I was lucky, and in that I had folks that were inclined to not only be outside but take a nudnik like myself out with them. You know, it's immensely helpful to have another person to kind of show you the ropes, you know, show you what to do, show you what not to do. It's a, you know, waterfowl is a tough sport to get into. You know, folks think of Pennsylvania as a big game state by and large, top three probably in black bear, top five more than likely in whitetail deer. I'm really speaking out of school in terms of, you know, these sorts of numbers, but
well, let me just say I gotta throw this in here, 'cause this just happened. They just had the Boone and Crockett, convention a couple weeks ago in Springfield, Missouri at Bass Pro Shops. We had the number one entry in whitetail deer. We had the number one black bear and the number one elk. So that's where we were this year. I mean, that's big news.
I took the golf ball and the tee and I set it right there for you.
And I'm not a golfer.
But so, I mean, to the extent Pennsylvania it has a reputation as a big game state, I'd also submit that it's a pretty darn good waterfowl state as well. You know, we've got this mountain chain that kind of runs, you know, through the state, and that, you know, that hill and valley region is a little unique in terms of, you know, in terms of waterfowl, where you find agriculture, where you find water, you know, you'll find the birds, you know, typically, you know, where that West Branch Susquehanna River flows through those mountains, you'll find ag lands along there and you'll likely find birds. So it's not just a limited to a valley bottom kind of activity. But I mean, in terms of getting started, you know, I could throw out a bunch of cliches, and you hit the nail on the head in terms of, you know, drive time. Spending time behind that windshield and behind binoculars is a big part of it. You know, two things though that I would recommend is having folks sort of shift their focus not so much on, you know, killing big numbers of birds and trying to find big numbers of birds and you know, posting, you know, Facebook pictures and everything. Waterfowl hunters are great in terms of, you know, keeping feeds and certain information close to the vest while at the same time promoting their own amazing prowess out there in the field, you know, stacking big numbers up and things. But so much of waterfowl hunting is about patience and it's about people. And what I mean by that is, you're going to have bad days just like any other hunting endeavor. You know, and it's important to understand that there's a lot of factors, of course, that impact this activity that we love to do, you know, whether it be, you know, barometric pressure, you know, wind speed, wind direction, you know, hunting pressure, any number of things that'll impact, the birds and where they want to be. And it's exceedingly important for folks to be patient. You know, you might not pull limits every day, but there has to be an understanding, I think, to sort of appreciate the nature of the sport, the nature of the the environment where we find these birds. And then that brings me to the people side. You know, folks want to focus on, you know, prime spots, but so much of hunting in general, and particularly waterfowl hunting, is about the people. It's about your crew. It's about the guys that you run with, the guys that you're bouncing information off of that are telling you things in terms of what they're seeing. And they might not even be in your crew, but to be able to kind of have that free flow of information, to understand that, okay, those guys are going to be out on this neck of the valley this day. Why don't we try over here? You know, rather than hunt that field right next to them or the farm, you know, a quarter mile down the road. Let's give them some space. Let's show them some respect. And then when we have that real hot field or that hot pond or whatever, they're going to show the same courtesy to us and not, you know, booger things up. Also about the people is those permissions. So much of waterfowl hunting, for better or for worse, occurs on private lands here in this Commonwealth. That's a function of economics and a whole lot of things. But the bottom line is, in order to enjoy a certain measure of success, you're going to have to knock on doors, and you're going to have to be accustomed to hearing the word no. You're going to have to, you know, figure out ways to work around that. And let me say too that, you know, when you get that no from a landowner, when you first knock on their door, it doesn't necessarily end the story right there. You know, a number of years ago, I was up in Canada with some buddies and knocking on doors, trying to get permissions. And we were kind of striking out, particularly on the western side of the Ottawa River, on the Quebec side. We were having a hard time getting in on those places. On the Ontario side, a little more success. And there was one feed that we really were watching and were trying to get on. The landowner initially said no. Well, we didn't just turn around and leave the farm and tuck our tails and head out. We just kept with the small talk. And we're talking with the farmer. Soon enough, her husband came out. And things sort of changed at some point during that simple little 5-minute conversation where she said, well, you know, you guys don't seem that bad. Why don't you come back in the morning? We ended up offering to take her husband out. He had never shot a goose before, even though he lived in, you know, within eyesight of the Ottawa River. And he got his first goose that morning. He had a great hunt. It was a nice mixed bag shoot of puddlers and Canadas. And from that farm, you know, we got permission on her brother's farm. So, you know, by the time we left that trip, we had a total of close to 1,600 acres in this wow. area, and we made some friends in the process.
And you just hit it right on the head. Waterfowl hunting is about just being around people and having fun, and I love what you said. I do have a biological question. If you shoot a Canada goose in Canada, is it a Canadian goose?
That's a complicated
answer. Because I hear a lot of people, and I'm myself included, that didn't understand that. When I got around waterfowlers for the first time and I said Canadian goose, I mean, they had a fit. They were ready to, you know, cut me. So explain that Canada goose is not a Canadian goose, please.
It's a Canada goose. That's their name. And sure, technically, they could be a Canadian goose, but keep in mind, we send a lot of birds north to molt each year. So they could be a PA goose, even if you're shooting them in Canada. So.
Right. There's nothing stopping them. It's just one of those pet peeves with waterfowlers. But, you know, and I'm going out of Pennsylvania for a second, and it might happen here. I'm sure it does. But my first experience with waterfowling really when I lived in Iowa, and folks would go to North Dakota and South Dakota and have these big blind boats, and they'd get in there and cook breakfast and bacon and eggs, and I'm sure y'all have experienced some of that stuff. That was more fun to them than hunting ducks. It was just that camaraderie that you have with other hunters and introducing somebody new. And from, you know, from like what you said, one of the best ways to introduce somebody, you know, I always say turkey hunting, but it sounds like waterfowling could be a great first step into hunting. Cause you don't literally,
especially if you want to shoot something.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I mean, you need a shotgun and some bullets, some ammunition. You don't, you know, if you got buddies that can call, you don't need a duck call or a goose call. Let's talk about calling and how important or how not important you think it is. I mean, obviously, scouting is at the top of for anything. If you want to hunt whitetails, you got to be where they're at. If you want to hunt turkeys, you got to be out there where you can hear one gobble in the spring or know where they're at in the fall. If you want to hunt squirrels, you got to be where the squirrels are at. I mean, waterfowl is the same way. So scouting's there, but let's talk about calls and decoys, because you don't need one of these rigs with trailer behind your truck and all that to get started.
Yeah, that's right. And on the point of calling, you know, I'd say knowing when to call is just as important as knowing when to shut up.
That's calling anything.
Indeed. And waterfowl, you know, our web-footed friends are no different. There are obviously certain things they like to hear at certain times. And it really is sort of an effort in trial and error to kind of learn that. You know, I'm a big fan of softer calling. Even in a big wide open cut cornfield, I'm typically not ripping on a duck or a goose call. You know, my sort of go-to is, you know, I'll do a soft little greeting, maybe some feeding. But I'll instead of watching the entire flock of birds, I'll try to focus on one bird. I'll try to pick out one bird and focus on that one bird and see how that one bird reacts to my call. It's the same thing with gunning. You know, you don't flock shoot, right? You don't shoot at the flock of birds. You pick one bird out and you know, you point your shotgun and you squeeze one off. I see calling is no different. I try not to focus on the, you know, that group of 50 or whatever it may be. Instead, just focus on one. And I tell you, you get one to turn, it can do wonders for that rest of that group to kind of convince them that, okay, hey, everything's cool down there. Let's go feed or let's go drink, whatever the case may be.
Yeah. I mean, the classic Nash Buckingham quote, and I'm going to butcher it a little bit, but, you know, a duck call in the hands of the unskilled is conservation's greatest asset. So
I love it.
I mean, it's knowing how to call. Honestly, when you're starting, just save that for your car. Practice in the car. Watch other people do it.
Right.
You're going to kill more birds, because a lot of guys will say it, but you can go up and down the river and hear kazoos all day long. And they're scaring birds off.
Sure.
They're not helping themselves. And so,
well, turkeys are the same way, and calling to any game, whether it's deer, turkeys, and I'm assuming waterfowl the same way. You know, the biggest mistake people make on turkeys is honestly one of the biggest mistakes is calling when that bird's coming in and can see the location, because when he doesn't see a hen over there or they don't see another turkey, I'm sure waterfowl's the same way. You know, if something, you know, if you're focusing that attention on something that looks wrong, they're going to go the other way. And well, and practicing, I agree with you. You know, I've been waterfowl hunting. I don't know enough about it to be dangerous, but I've gone to Middle Creek the last couple of years, and I want to talk about that in a little bit. And you can hear other people, and they got that duck call, and they think they're in Stuttgart. You know, it's like, meh, meh. I mean, as loud as they can go, and the ducks don't want anything to do with it. I mean, they sound good, like they hear on YouTube or whatever, somebody up there on stage, but it's not effective to get ducks to come into your decoy spread.
And I think it's probably safe to say that at certain areas you just don't call.
Sure.
And perhaps Middle Creek is one of those areas. You know, it's a regulated hunting area, and it gets a lot of attention. You know, so you've got the project proper where, you know, the commission has on a drawing basis allows individuals and groups and things to hunt those fixed blinds, those fixed points. But all around Middle Creek is an entire suite of pits and private leases and everything else that really, frankly, get hammered. And, you know, the best advice I think I could probably give somebody for the first time hunting at Middle Creek is just leave your calls in the blind bag.
Well, it's kind of funny when you say that, when you, I think it's over at noon, correct? At Middle Creek, you have to stop at noon.
I think it's one.
Or one.
You got to be out at one.
Yeah. So as soon as that lunch bell rings at noon, everybody's getting out, and you look in the sky, and it's full of waterfowl. Mm-hmm. And they know. I mean, they just know. And we'll just, I'd like to talk about these controlled hunt opportunities that we have in Pennsylvania. And you know, my experience 2 years ago, I got invited by our deputy executive director, Dave Mitchell, to go down there and bring my daughter. And she's never been waterfowl hunting. She doesn't want to miss that opportunity. Yeah, it's not, you're not sitting there shooting continuously, but you got to kind of manage your 10 shells that you got to take. And we had a blast. And the blast was the people that were in the blind with us just having fun and eating deer bologna and, you know, BSing. And then all of a sudden there's a duck. And by the time you know it, it's folded up, landed in your decoys. And you're like, how did that happen? And it's just, that's the whole experience. But if you would, Nate, let's talk about a little bit about Middle Creek and Pimatuni and the opportunities that we're real fortunate to have here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, they're two, at least for now, there are two unique controlled hunting experiences. So you can put into the draw, draws open right now.
Till a couple days, I think.
Yeah. It might be closed by the end, by the time this airs.
But, that's right.
Yeah, you can put in for the draw. You can
next
draw,
year.
Yeah. You can draw a goose blind. Also, each of them has controlled duck hunting areas. Middle Creek, you have to put in for those a week ahead of time. Pimatuni, you kind of show up the day of, the morning of. And both of them offer, quote-unquote, kind of no-show opportunities. So if somebody's not going to fill a blind, or for then either at Pimatuni, you got to show up the morning of, and you can potentially draw one of those blinds, or at Middle Creek, you, again, put in the week ahead of time, and they'll let you know the next day whether or not you can come on up. And, two really unique opportunities. Great. Most of the blinds at Middle Creek are pit blinds. At Pimatuni, they just got a bunch of pit blinds, so I'm not sure exactly what the ratio is of pit blinds to above ground blinds, but kind of Middle Creek has a couple of above ground blinds too, at least as it pertains to duck blinds. So
yeah, if you're new and you want to, you know, check it out, obviously our website has all the information. I know, yep. In the digest there's some information on Middle Creek and Pimatuni, and it's, you know, obviously public hunting, which we're, you know, we talk about Pennsylvania, we're just lucky to have those opportunities that a lot of places don't have, that our state does, because of our forefathers being smart enough to put land aside for wildlife.
Well, and I'll be the first to say too that some of the improvements that have been made out at those controlled hunting areas in the last few years haven't gone unnoticed. You know, from the concealed comfort, you know, pit lines, pardon the pitch. You know, it's a nice experience. You know, many of them have, you know, places for dogs. Most of them are big enough for 6 to 8 people. And, it really helps to engender a nice experience. And waterfowl hunting is that kind of thing where, you know, instead of having to, you know, real quiet, skulk into your hunting location and be quiet and communicate in hushed tones. I mean, waterfowl hunters are cutting up. They're, you know, they're making fun of each other. They're, you know, like you said, fixing breakfast, whatever the case may be. And then, of course, when there's birds in the area, then it's go time. But that was one thing that really drew me to this sport.
And you shoot your shotgun dry and don't hit anything, and everybody laughs and has fun. And
that happens time to time, once in a while.
It's hunting. I mean, we miss. I mean, it's wing shooting, and you know, we just participated in a sporting clay shoot last Friday, and you know, I haven't shot since a year ago. The same shoot, and
no one called me.
Well, that was on purpose.
I figured.
But we, if you don't practice too, shooting, I mean, it's just like turkey hunting. People are like, how do you miss a turkey that's standing still? Well, it's a lot harder to hit something on the wing. So, you know, practicing with your firearm is important, especially, you know, you can go shoot clay birds anywhere. You know, every weekend there's a sportsman's club somewhere shooting trap skeet. And, you know, if you have a buddy that has some land, you go out there and hand throw them. I don't care what it is. You got to practice moving that gun. You know, when you miss something that's in the air, it's because you stopped your gun or you pulled your head off the stock to look and see where it's at. And same thing with a clay bird. But, you know, so many times we take it for granted. And knowing that, you know, we learned on Red Riders trying to shoot stuff out of the air with a BB gun when I was a kid, and you got good at it and you got good at pointing a gun. I think it's something that's overlooked a lot. We don't shoot enough. We don't go out there and burn ammunition.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I was that guy that was the brunt of the jokes for a lot of years when I first took this game up. And I sort of resolved about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago to spend every Saturday I could at that sportsman club, you know, shooting 50 birds and just seeing the targets, and then and then trying to understand what you did wrong is a big part of it. But you know, the diehard clays guys will tell you, you know, it gets easier after you see 10,000 targets. So there is hope.
So we're, you know, getting close to the end. I do want to talk about something negative a little bit. It's negative, but we're going to make the most positive out of it that we can, and that's avian influenza. You know, obviously there's been a big scare across the country, especially, you know, here in the East Coast. But, you know, and I know we talked about the difference between high path and, you know, avian influenza and, yeah, and just the word itself. So if you would just a little bit talk about what it is, Nate, and tell us as hunters what we should be doing out there.
Sure. So avian influenza is something that actually pretty much every duck you've probably ever encountered has. But in the low path form. So low path meaning it's generally not transmitted that well from waterfowl to other species. But yeah, I worked on an avian influenza project in Ohio once, and basically on August 15th, you go from all the juvenile birds to never having had it to every one of them having an active infection. It's kind of crazy. But that virus can kind of change a little bit and become high path avian influenza. And that's a little more concerning. It transmits really well to lots of other species, particularly domestic poultry and things like that get it, and it'll just wipe the entire flock out. So pretty much once every 5 to 10 years, we kind of see this high path run through pretty much the entire world. I mean, waterfowl migrate to the Arctic. They share breeding grounds with many different species. And so we've seen this high path kind of move from Europe most recently, was first detected in the Atlantic Flyway last, and I'm going to be wrong here, it was either December or January in New Brunswick. And since then, it's now been detected in every single flyway across the country. And we continue to have active infections, even in the lower 48, particularly in black vultures, we're seeing it in a lot.
They don't taste very good.
No, and but we're seeing birds dying off from it. So it's still circulating on the landscape during a time of the year when things are warmer. The virus isn't viable as long in the environment. But as it gets colder, you know, it's likely that we'll continue to see that kind of uptick. Generally speaking, for a high path AI, it doesn't really negatively impact waterfowl. Some of our more sea ducks, they'll get hit a little bit harder by it, but we probably wouldn't expect, you know, geese and ducks to be declining as a result of this recent outbreak.
So is it kind of like influenza like that we get. It's like getting the flu.
Yeah.
So they, I mean, survivability is pretty good.
Basically.
For wild animals.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, like there's points in time when you can test most ducks and they'll all have it, even though they won't die from it. But yeah, if it gets into domestic poultry, that can be a much bigger issue. So, more than likely, I think we're going to see it again, kind of rear up, this fall into winter. Again, it's the virus stays a lot more viable, into the, when water temps are colder. And birds tend to congregate a lot more during fall and winter. So, we kind of expect that to happen. Not sure how bad it's going to be. It was pretty bad, especially for domestic poultry producers last year. I'd be wrong to try and assume whether or not it's going to be worse or not.
So what should hunters do, you know, just for precautions, would you suggest?
Yeah. So generally speaking, it's not a human health concern that I'm aware of. There's only been two people who have actually gotten this strain. Both of them lived or worked with it very actively around either captive birds, whether it was domestic or a rehab facility. So it's not really a human health concern, but if you have domestic poultry at home, I would make sure that those boots that you're wearing in the field aren't making their way home. I would clean your birds somewhere else, just bringing meat home, you know, keeping that wing attached because you have to. But, you know, just being really, really conscientious about biosecurity. And for our domestic, those commercial poultry facilities, yeah, that biosecurity is going to be really, really important. But generally speaking, if you follow your biosecurity stuff, you shouldn't have a problem.
And if you want more information, I know we talked about it earlier, they can hit the, is it the USDA has a landing page on the
avian influenza. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So they've got it for both domestic, for both wild and, commercial.
Okay. Well, thank you. And that's important news because obviously we want to keep it out of, you know, the domestic population of, even if you have chickens at home, you know, like you said, and by law, if you do field dress your duck or goose in the field, you have to keep a wing attached.
Yeah. A fully feathered wing or a fully feathered head.
Okay. Great, great stuff. So let's switch back to good news. Obviously we have to be vigilant out there, but you know, here at PGC, you know, we're in some really great times right now and lucky to do a lot of the things that you see going on out there on the ground. And I wanted to hit on about the habitat improvement projects. If you could give just a quick overview of some of the stuff that we have going on here within the agency, whether it's on state game lands or private lands or, you know, what you're seeing out there. I know you're out there every week in boots in the dirt, and the part of the projects that I've seen, like especially up in the Northwest region, are pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty cool time to be around. There's a lot going on. And, you know, one thing we started, back in 2020, and we're kind of seeing this through and into 2024, 2025, I think we'll hopefully, be finishing up, but we started an inventory of all of our water control structures. Basically that gives us the ability to manipulate water on these wetlands. And, through that, we identified a bunch of them that needed repairs or needed to be replaced. And so, we just went through a ranking process to kind of prioritize where we're going to spend, what we've been, given at this point is about $6 million over the next 3 years to, you know, repair and replace these water control structures. And, just a couple of weeks ago, we just did a wetland management, 101 for all of our land managers. Had about 50 folks come into Harrisburg and go check out Middle Creek and check out Haldeman and see the things that are going on there. And so really, yeah, there's a lot of momentum right now on water, you know, and this isn't just, you know, I do hear that from hunters from time to time that the only place we spend money is Middle Creek and Biomatuning. And that's simply not the case with this. The map includes every single PGC region, and projects, across the entire state. So it's really exciting and, really going to improve, you know, our habitat.
And we're living in great times and not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the country. When you look at conservation, you know, even down to the Pittman-Robertson, funds that are received throughout the country, you know, lots of people are shooting guns and buying bows and arrows and supporting conservation. And that's a big word. And sometimes out there in people that buy hunting licenses, myself included, we don't realize where all those dollars go. And like the stuff that I've seen that's coming through the waterfowl projects are just amazing. And, you know, like I said, it might not be today that it affects things, but 30 years from now, it's definitely going to make a major milestone effect on a lot of those populations. And we're always going to have to deal with diseases. And you know, we're able to be ready and be vigilant when these things occur and try to get the right things done, whether it's white-tailed deer with CWD. You know, we obviously just had a domestic pop of rabbit hemorrhagic disease. There's lots of things going on out there. And we're fortunate to live in a state that can be on the forefront of trying to get the right things done. So, Cree, anything else exciting you want to talk about as a waterfowler? I see a big smile on your face. You got to have something good for us.
Well, it's I had Christmas music playing in my head on my way into work this morning.
What it song is, in particular?
The Most Wonderful Time of the Year.
Nice. Nice. Can you sing that or rap it or something? Because earlier we were talking about your rapping career.
I'll work on that.
Okay.
I'll save that one for the next go around.
All right. But it is. This is the most wonderful time of the year. We're seeing daylight. I mean, you wake up early and the sun's not out yet. Daylight hours are shortening. You know, bucks are starting to lose their velvet and thinking about, you know, what's happening here. It's amazing what wildlife, the transition that happens day to day from now until, well, it's all year, but like from now till Christmas time, lots of things going. And the problem is the more birthdays we have as humans, the faster the time goes. And y'all are young, so you don't know that yet, but you will see that when you're old like me, you blink and it's, you know, Christmas is here again. But
I've got a few wisdom whiskers in there, Matt.
I see that. Yeah, yeah. That happens. Yeah. That's birthdays. How about you, Nate? Anything exciting that you want to talk about?
I guess the one thing I did fail to mention when we were talking about those populations was that Atlantic population of Canada geese also saw an uptick in those birds. So they've had some good luck on the breeding grounds after 10 years of poor production. So they're on the uptick again. So hopefully hunters in Southeast PA, where we see the majority of those birds stop over, we'll see a few more birds this fall too.
Awesome. And, you know, and if anybody tunes in that's, you know, that doesn't buy a hunt license but just likes to see wildlife, you know, that's Pymatuning in Middle Creek, like we talked about, like the snow goose migration at Middle Creek is unbelievable. I mean, it's one of the wonders of the world, if you ask me, when you get down there, when they're in full swing. And any advice for hunters out there, Cree, before we close out for the day?
Well, I would just go back to your point that you just made, that, you know, it isn't just the controlled areas where you can do this wildlife watching. You know, folks that are interested in watching birds can really go to any state game lands. And this is a plug for the game lands complex generally. I've seen some things on game lands that you just don't see in other places, frankly. And I think that's a testament to the agency and the efforts of the individuals that are out there managing the land as well as managing for the species. So, big shout out to the land managers and things out there for the work they do on game lands and elsewhere. But no, it's good that there was finally some research and survey work up in the Great North, and it's encouraging that there was some good information coming out of that. And all I can say is a lot of us are leaning on you and hoping for more continued good news, Nathan.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. We'll hopefully have there'll be more to come.
Well, let's plan on this one again next year, you know, for waterfowl season. And we appreciate you coming and joining us this morning on, you know, like I said, the cusp of hunting season. And going back to what Cree said real quick, if you check out our website, there's a lot of game land tours. If you've never been to a state game lands, there's a lot of game land tours where they open up the gates you can drive through that's coming up this fall. Highly encourage you to go take a look at what's going on the ground. But, gentlemen, thank you. Good luck if you get out there in the field. And from all of us in our bureau and all of you know, the folks out there, we appreciate what you all do for the Pennsylvania Game Commission and for conservation. And thanks again for joining us this morning.
No, thanks. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been great.
On behalf of the Pennsylvania Game Commission, thank you for tuning in. And we hope that every day of field is filled with memories to last a lifetime. We are committed to leave conservation and wildlife better for the future. And we hope you can tune in next time to the PGC's Call of the Outdoors.